I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. Casey Gerald grew up outside of Dallas in a family struggling with drugs and mental illness. He attended Yale University and Harvard Business School, was declared one of the most creative people in business by Fast Company, opened for President Obama at South by Southwest, inspired President Bush with his life story. His TED Talk, The Gospel of Doubt, has been viewed more than a million times. Sounds like he's the embodiment of the American dream, the notion that anyone in this country can pull themselves up by their bootstraps. Well, not so fast. Casey Gerald punctures that myth and rejects the up-from-poverty narrative in his moving new memoir, There Will Be No Miracles Here, about what he calls the, quote, incredible price that must be paid to be free. He joins us on Radio Times to tell us about the role that race and queer sexuality and poverty and class have played in his life and what it reveals about our country. And Casey Gerald, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
So very good to be with you.
Nice to have you with us. I want to have you read from the very beginning of your book, the very first page.
I do not want the world to end. Nobody asked me, though. Boy, you too young to have an opinion. They cry and cry each time I offer up a couple cents. Maybe so. Maybe. But if 12 is too young to think, it sure as hell is too young to die. I guess it won't be death. I will simply disappear in the twinkling of an eye right around midnight on the last night of this world, 31 December 1999. When Jesus Christ returns to set his kingdom up for good and for good reason. Things have really gone to shit since he's been gone. Ever since he got himself killed for trying to help the weak and poor and scorned around Judea. And since he fled back home to lick his wounds, to spend 2,000 years in exile. And since his buddies spread a story in his stead to men and women everywhere, some of whom were so inspired that they too wound up hung and shot and flayed for similar transgressions. And still, somehow, it seems each day, there are more poor, more weak, more scorned among the earth, myself included, which is why the Son of Man is on his way to pick me up. Just a minute.
I love that way that you opened the book, and I have to say this is a story that you have told before, part of your TED Talk, about that moment when you thought the world was going to end, and then, of course, it didn't. Why do you keep coming back to this story?
Well, in part because I want to understand it. You know, my grandfather was a preacher, and he preached for 40 years, and I was always marveled by his job, which was to tell a 2,000-year-old story over and over and over again, you know, with new language and with new illumination. I started this book because I'd lived myself into a dead end. You know, I had achieved about everything a kid is supposed to achieve in this country, but I was very cracked up, and a lot of my friends were cracked up, and the world was cracked up. This was 2016. Yes. So I started out just to trace those cracks with words. And what I found was that America, the world in many ways, was as much of a dead end as I was. And so I come back to this story because it's not about the religious question of the end of the world necessarily and Jesus coming back and whatever, whatever. It actually at base is a great metaphor for this human question of what do you do when your world has ended, you see? And that sets off the rest of the journey.
And what do you do when someone tells you something that doesn't happen? I mean, you could call it a lie. There are many things that we could call that. Yeah. But what happens when someone promises something but doesn't deliver?
Absolutely. Well, you know, I tell people all the time that my generation has perhaps been lied to more than any.
You think so?
You know, I mean, maybe not. I mean, maybe the, you know, boomers in the 60s, you know, were lied to quite a bit for sure. But the reality is that almost every institution my generation has inherited has been compromised. You know, we were in high school when 9/11 happened. I was a summer intern at Lehman Brothers. You know, we lived through the disaster of the, well, we're still living through the disaster of the quote-unquote war on terror, you see. And so It is this question of being disappointed, and not in a pointing the finger kind of way, but actually in a, let's actually sit and understand the trauma of that and what it would look like to heal.
You said cracked up. Yeah. I mean, do you feel like you had a nervous breakdown, or you just felt like I have had all this attention, all this quote unquote mm-hmm. success, and I need to see who I am and figure things out?
Well, I want to be very careful with the language of nervous breakdown. My mother suffered and still suffers from a bipolar, and so I don't want to be flippant with language of mental illness. But I will say what I always say, which is everything you run from comes running after you. You see, I received an email last night from a woman who had read my book who was just sort of stunned. And she said, there's so much in your story I don't relate to, but I'm a suburban 60-year-old white woman. And what I can relate to is a horrific childhood. And I tried to ignore that childhood until I was 50. Mm-hmm. And then I just fell apart and I had to deal with it. So much of this book is about facing those things that you really don't want to face, that you have to face before you can move forward. And that's why it plays both at the personal and the political level.
You write in great detail and in many ways with a lot of love about your parents. Your mm-hmm. father was a really talented football player, mm-hmm. a quarterback. Mm-hmm. He got injured, and in certain ways it seems as if back in those days you give people drugs, you put them back on the field. That created problems for him.
Yeah. I remember when I was in sixth grade, I walked into class and my teacher handed me a copy of the Dallas Morning News. And my father was on the front cover. It says, "Once the pride of Texas, South Oak Cliff star threw away his life for drugs." Mm. I said, "Oh man, that's a really bad dude, you know." Well, it just so happened as I was researching this book, I found that the story was more complicated. My father is still considered by many to be one of the greatest high school football players in the history of the state of Texas. He went on.
Which is saying something. Because we know about football
in
Texas.
Absolutely. I mean, we won't. I know we're in Philadelphia. I don't want to, you know.
You don't want to rile up
down.
Our fans.
Yeah, I don't want to be
right?
run down when I come out of the studio. But he goes off to Ohio State. He's second black quarterback in the history of the program, played for Woody Hayes. His sophomore year, he breaks his back in a game against Purdue. Mm. Later that season, Ohio State makes it to the Orange Bowl. Woody wants him to play. He wants to play. He's not totally healed. Before the game, somebody comes and says, "You want me to give you something to make you play like a champion?" He gives him an envelope with cocaine in it.
Wow.
He takes it. He's MVP of the Orange Bowl, has the game of his life. He never plays again without using. And things spiral from there. So one of the big things I was trying to do with this book is to trouble the villain hero narratives, the flat narratives that we get, whether it's about, you know, folks who are drug addicts or, you know, folks who are president.
He called you Scooter.
Scooter, yeah, which I still don't understand, which I still rather like. Actually.
I do, too.
Yeah,
it feels kind of old-fashioned in a way for a dad to call his son Scooter. You also write about your mom, and as you said, she was, or perhaps still is, bipolar. Mm-hmm. And there was a time when you were young, 12, maybe 13, mm-hmm. where she just disappeared. I mean, she said, "I'll be back." And then she disappeared.
Yeah. It's funny. I have a line in the book that says, "If ever your mother asks you to choose between her death and disappearance, have her die always, though not immediately, of course. You see. My mother was really a magical creature. I tell folks she kind of reminds me of a mix of Blanche DuBois from Streetcar Named Desire in the 1980s, Whitney Houston.
What a combo.
I mean, a great combination,
and
actually.
You often have picked we see her in front of the mirror,
uh-huh.
you know,
yeah,
getting ready.
Beautiful, gorgeous person, but also just a strange bird, you know. And she disappeared, I thought, when I was 12. And this gets to what I'm saying about how vital it is to trace the cracks, whether you're talking about a life or a country. I thought most of my life she disappeared when I was 12. Then I started researching the book, and it turns out she disappeared when I was 13. Yeah. She was around for a whole year after I had internalized her being gone. And that says something very real to me about how little we actually understand the most important things that happened to us. But I had to take a step further. Because this was the worst thing that ever happened to me. You know, my mother was my best friend, and she just disappeared one day. I just assumed she was dead. To fill in the plot, she sort of reappeared 5 years later out of the blue when I was 18. But I was so angry and I was so hurt, and so many early drafts of that material were just like, I hate you, I hate you, I hate you. That has no literary value, of course. But I was able to get on the other side and see my mother as a human being, not just as my employee. And when I
as
did,
your employee, as
you
her
see,
son.
You see what I'm saying?
I do.
And when I did that, I was able to see that the worst thing that ever happened to me was perhaps the most important thing she ever did for herself.
Do you think she was running for her life in a way?
Oh, without question. I mean, listen, I saw a few days ago that suicide is the second leading cause of death for young people in this country. I mean, that shouldn't surprise anyone. I mean, we've heard it over and over again. The failure in this society to actually support people who are at base having a hard time, and more specifically are dealing with serious mental illness, is, I think, a scandal. And I saw it 20 years ago, you know, going to the psychiatric hospitals with my mother.
Yeah, where she was hospitalized.
Sure.
But the thing, I guess, since you put your family out there, we as readers, we get to have our opinions or even judge, is that when she disappeared, nothing was said. When she came back, nothing was said. And I'm just trying to imagine being a young boy, very close to your mother, and there's no explanation that could help, it seems to me, a young person understand what might have been going on.
Sure. This book, and hopefully my life, is not just a memoir. It is an intervention. You see, I'll give you an example. When I was writing it, my mother started disappearing again.
Oh,
okay.
Really?
And
More recently then.
Yeah. And my niece was 12 at the time.
Oh, wow.
And
that would be your sister's child.
My sister's child, yeah. And as heartbreaking as it was to see her go through the same things that I had gone through at that very age, and to see these responses that people say, oh, Kendall's checking on folks, she's such a sweet kid. And I say, no, actually, that is very alarming, that she's afraid that everybody is like disappearing all of a sudden, so she's checking on you for those reasons. So as heartbreaking as that was, it actually was a great gift as it pertained to the book, because it set the standard. If there's not something in this book that can help my niece feel that she's not alone, feel that she can understand the trauma that she's experiencing, feel that she can get on the other side of it, and not just my niece, but all these other young people who are going through these awful experiences, then what is the book worth, you see? And so that was a very hard but very helpful in some ways experience to go through as I was writing.
We're up on a break here, but it's interesting that, you know, you talk about 1999, December 31st, is a kind of a way to disappear from the planet, right? I mean, if the rapture were to come, and then, of course, having to actually live with your mom disappearing on you.
Yeah. I tell people, I didn't want the world to end. I write this in the book. I want it to be rescued.
Right.
Yeah.
Very different.
Don't we all?
Don't we all? That's Casey Gerald, our guest on Radio Times today. We're talking about his memoir, and it's called There Will Be No Miracles Here. You can join our conversation. Much more to talk about, as you can probably tell. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us, WHYY Radio Times, to join the conversation. Do stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen, talking with Casey Gerald about his new book. It's a memoir titled There Will Be No Miracles Here. I do want to go back to your grandfather, who had this mega church in, was it in Dallas or was it in Dallas itself? You write, when he was in the greatest business in America, saving souls. But this was one of those mega churches that we think of as thousands of people coming to church?
Well, it was not quite that yet. You talk about a life. His grandmother had been born a slave. He was raised in a little dirt floor house in Dawson, Texas. Starts preaching at 16, making canned goods. This was his compensation.
Oh, wow.
He got to Dallas and joined a church preaching, and then founded his own church. And he and my grandmother were the first black people to integrate Oak Cliff, my neighborhood in Dallas. And they were moved in, they were egged, they were, you know, called niggas as they walked down the street. You see what I'm saying?
I do.
It was a very dangerous experience. And so that church was not just a religious exercise. It was a safe space and in many ways a cornerstone for people who were coming in trying to find some way to be in the world that was very hostile to them. I have to tell this story because it's been on my heart so much.
Go ahead.
You know, and this is people are leaving in my generation the church, and very rightfully so, and hopefully we talk about that. But this is what's so beautiful about the role of the Black church, especially in the South and perhaps in other places in the country historically. A cousin of mine, Rhoda Faye, always was having a horrible time. I mean, didn't have any money, didn't have a job, and, you know, all this kind of stuff. And people say, oh, Rhoda Faye is a mess, y'all, you know, whatever. And that might be true for 364 days of the year. And then Easter Sunday came.
Oh.
And Rhoda Faye would recite every Easter The Crucifixion by James Weldon Johnson. And she'd get up, and every year she'd have the same tired hat with the, you know, dirt on the inside and all this kind of stuff, and the same little, you know, cubic zirconia rings and all this kind of stuff. Say, oh, here's Rhoda Faye coming again. And she'd stand up and she'd say, she'd hold her head up high and she'd say, I will now recite The Crucifixion by James Weldon Johnson. I mean, you see, I mean, here is a society that for almost 400 years has tried to destroy these people. And that might work for 364 days of the year. But here was this one day in the church where she could stand up and she could recite The Crucifixion by James Weldon Johnson and be the greatest person on the planet. I mean, it was incredible.
Yeah, and people, I'm assuming, expecting it every year.
Oh,
and,
man, waiting just, for it.
Yeah,
you
waiting
know what
for
I mean?
It, exactly.
You know, it was an event.
Right.
And so, you know, people have talked about this book as being sort of hard to categorize. It's so political, it's so spiritual, it's so personal. I mean, so is life. And I think the job of literature ought to be to bring the real expression to the human experience, not to just prove you know a lot of words.
Well, help us understand then your relationship to the church, even as a child growing up. Mm-hmm. I'm sure there were sermons or readings about homosexuality being a sin. How did you understand that, or even grapple with it as a young person, or maybe even now?
I had to let go of the God I was given to find the God I needed. And in a lot of ways, the greatest gift on that journey was being a homosexual, because there was no reconciling. My uncle died of AIDS in 1994, my grandfather's son, and to see, so did three or four other of our choir members, and to see how they were, I was seven or eight at the time, to see how they were discarded and dehumanized before I even had any understanding of my sexuality. So I spent so much of my youth trying to get rid of this gift, trying to ignore it, you see, trying to pray it away. You know, I'd call it the Trinity Broadcasting Network and say, well, y'all pray for me to be delivered.
Did you really?
Oh,
you call
sure.
Into the...
Yeah. They were very nice people.
Didn't work, apparently.
No, thankfully it didn't. But this took such a toll on me that at some point I didn't want to be alive, you see. And so many queer young people in our society have reached that point where they just can't see any other way than to get out of here. Well, when I reached that point, I figured I'm not going to die in this life to avoid hell in the next. I'm not going to mutilate myself for God's love. Now, initially, I took on kind of the stance of a spurned lover, you know what I mean? To hell with him, you know, he ain't nothing, you know, I don't need him, that kind of thing. And that lasted for a while, and then I got so low, and I reached this point in my life where I didn't know what to do or where to turn. And at that moment, something grabbed me, you see. And I called that something God. But a friend sent me a sermon, and the minister said, if you really want to know God, the best way is to assume you know nothing about God. And that's where I am, Marty, you see. I am every day trying to build a relationship with this mystery, with this stranger that is more real and more important to me than any other thing in my life.
God more than the church?
The church is dead. I mean, let's be very clear. And it should have been dead a long time ago. I mean, if Jesus Christ himself, I mean, little poor, crazy Jesus of Nazareth, I'm not talking about Jesus Christ, the totem pole, came back and walked into a church, he'd be apoplectic. I mean, he'd probably just faint. He'd die all over again. I mean, it's nuts. So I think so many of my friends and my peers had to, whether they were queer or not, had to find something else other than this church thing that we were given. Right. But that does not mean that we've forfeited our spiritual life.
Let me ask you about something else, about some teachers and even some coaches that you had growing up. Mm-hmm. You had, I think it was a kindergarten or maybe nursery school, mm-hmm. a wonderful teacher. You did not want to take a nap along with the other kids. And rather than like forcing you to lie down mm-hmm. and pretend to take a nap, mm-hmm. she allowed you to just sort of live in your imagination and to be quietly drawing letters in the air.
Yeah. You know, this book at base is about a journey to for all of us and for perhaps for also for our country to actually be free, to actually find a sense of liberation. So the question becomes, well, what does that look like actually? Yeah. And so this story of nap time in kindergarten is actually central to my understanding of what freedom and liberation looks like. I hated nap time. I had no idea why I would be forced to go to a place I didn't want to be and do something that I do better at home, you know, which is sleep.
You were here. You
exactly.
were in kindergarten to
yeah.
play. Or,
I was in kindergarten against my will. I mean, let's be clear.
Okay.
You know, as
Fair
are
enough.
Probably most 5 years. So nap time comes, and I said, no, I'm not going to do it. We had corporal punishment in Texas in those days. So they said, all right, well, you don't want to follow the rules, you'll get the ruler in your hand. Yeah, I took that, which says something good about me, I think. And so then they said, well, we'll give you candy if you go to sleep. And I took I loved candy. I still do. But I still wouldn't sleep. So eventually she said, well, what do you want to do? And I said, I don't know. I just don't want to go to sleep. And so she let me sit up while everybody else slept and write words from the wall on a little note card thing. And I use that as an example to say that this act of refusal, this simple act of refusal, no, I'm not going to go to sleep. No, I'm not going to do that, actually is the starting point for what freedom looks like. It was the starting mm-hmm. point of my love of language, actually, you see. So this book wouldn't have existed without breaking those rules.
And do you remember the name of that teacher?
Miss McLemore.
Miss McLemore.
Rita McLemore. Yeah, absolutely. I love her.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Casey Gerald, and we're talking about his new book. It's a memoir called There Will Be No Miracles Here, in part about growing up in Texas, just outside of Dallas. He went to Yale University, where he studied and played football. He also went on to Harvard Business School. And his book is really his puncturing of that myth that somehow, if you just pull yourself up by your bootstraps, you can be a success in America. Clearly, he is a success, but he is raising all sorts of really important and interesting questions about the price of something like that. You can join us 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me get Tanera from Philadelphia to join us, and Tanera called us up, and you're on the air. Tanera, go ahead.
Hi.
Hi there.
I just wanted to hear a little bit from TC about what kind of strategies and tactics you use to heal and to move past these levels of trauma in your life.
Good question. Thanks.
Thank you so much for that question. When you started it, I went to business school, so when you started it, I thought you were about to ask me about strategies for starting a business or something, so I really loved that question. Listen, you know, I was telling somebody the other day, I said, well, I've got a numerologist, an astrologist, two therapists, a meditation coach, a dermatologist,
and
a workout
right?
coach. Absolutely. You know, so it takes a lot of work. But we spend so much work doing stuff that makes no difference at all in our lives. Why not do a little more? I start every day with meditating and not any kind of, you know, voodoo business or whatever. I just sit and I try to breathe and I try to ground myself before I have any internal input from anything. I have a line in the book that says, I have a radio. It only plays two stations, life and death. I turn the death off now that I know the sound, the diddy bop of death. I sit in silence if I have to. So much of what I'm doing, tactically, strategically, and very practically, is just like going through the grocery store and trying to decide what to put in my basket and what to take out of my basket. So my sister calls yesterday with drama. I said, Tosh, can't do it. Took her out of my basket. I mean, I love my sister, right. But in that moment, what she had to offer me was not life-giving, and I had to remove it from the basket. Somebody sends emails at 3 o'clock in the morning, you see. You know, I'm not going to wake up out of my sleep and respond. I mean, some of this is very sort of in the weeds, but at base, it is really trying to be intimately in touch with how the external inputs are affecting my life. And anything that's not life-giving, I try to remove it, and I try to nourish myself.
So 5 years ago, you might have responded very differently to all that input?
Yeah, absolutely. 5 years ago, I had different goals. 5 years ago, I wanted to be a big star. I wanted to be rich. I wanted to be famous. You see what I'm saying? Right now, I want to be well. And you can't sometimes have it both ways.
You're right. And again, this is about your family. And I'm quoting here, we pretended that we were not a group of people who had destroyed each other. This was after your mother had come back to the family. Is that how you feel about them today? Or is that something you had to, in a sense, go through to be able to understand your family from their perspective?
Do I still feel that we were a group of people that had destroyed each other?
Yeah. Families can do that.
Sure, yeah. I'd imagine most of the 300-some million Americans feel that way, and probably most of the 7 billion people.
I'm sitting here nodding my head.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, yep.
You know, so,
but some families are harder than others.
Sure. And that does not mean that there's not love there. And that does not mean that we're throwing them overboard. You know, one of the things that this book taught me was that we are all happened to and happening on other people. And some of it is just trying to understand, well, you know, where does one begin and where does the other end, you see? So, yeah, I still feel that way, but it's not a feeling of bitterness. It's just trying to tell the truth.
Right. Mm-hmm. You write very honestly about falling in love or struggling with relationships with men that you met and maybe not feeling loved or knowing how to love or, I think you said, cowardly, sometimes selfishly. As I said, you were very honest about struggling, like who to be and how to be intimate with someone else.
Sure. You know, I was very hostile to the idea of writing a kind of abstract social study of, you know, being an oppressed gay person or something. You know, what I wanted to do with the book is bring worthy language to the beauty and challenge of loving another boy, in my case. A challenge in part because we live in a society that hates gay people and teaches us to hate ourselves, but also because for many years I was a coward.
Meaning?
I didn't have the basic muscle of courage, of taking a risk for someone else, you see.
Felt too dangerous or just
felt incredibly dangerous. Everyone who I'd ever depended on had, in my words, betrayed me, you see.
Right.
But I let that become an excuse. It might be a starting point, but as soon as it becomes an excuse, then it's dangerous. And you can't love somebody if you're not willing to take a risk.
Right.
It's a very dangerous exercise. So is everything else. That's what Maya Angelou used to always say, courage is the most important virtue, because without it, you can't practice any other virtue consistently. It's very true.
Yeah.
So this book, at base, it's also sort of a love story. You know, it's right in the weeds of intimate human experience. You know, intimate in there. It's not sort of standing out, you know, saying, oh, these people as a class, blah, blah, blah. No, it's in there, man. And it's about this journey to having enough courage to really live with a capital L. I'm not talking about just breathing and paying your mortgage.
Sure,
every month. Yeah.
Sure. But I don't think you have to be gay to be able to connect with that story about feeling courageous enough or crazy enough to throw yourself at another person.
I hope not. I mean, that's what the beautiful. Let's hope not. I mean, we're not going to sell many books if it's just. But what's beautiful about memoir and about personal narrative is that if you do it right, you can write through the I and get to the we. And you can't take a shortcut. You can't start at the we and say, oh, you know, hey, me and Marty, you know, I come from a family of all black people, as far as I know.
Right.
If I went out on the street corner and started to speak on behalf of my family, I mean, they'd stage a mutiny against me. I can't even speak on behalf of my sister. I've known her all my life. How in the hell am I going to speak on behalf of, you know, millions of people? But if I get in the eye, then maybe I'll find 20, 30, 40% of that that you relate to, too.
Well, interestingly, then, has your family read your memoir? I mean, do they recognize the family that you have written about? And I don't think any family who has a family member write a memoir, they would write a different book, I'm assuming. But what do they think about the book that you've written?
Well, it sort of goes back to this I-we thing. It depends on who you're talking about. My mother and grandmother, I mean, I have all women in my family, and I just love it. My mother read an article about the book. She hadn't even read the book yet. And so if her response to the articles are any indication, then if she ever reads the book, this might be sort of a replayed interview as a memorial for me, you know,
really?
Kind of thing. And she went on and she said, and she really had a kind of big meltdown. She said, I can't believe, you know, why is he saying that I abandoned him? This is so not true. And this is, oh, it's breaking my heart. And my grandmother, her mother, says, oh, Deborah, come on. She says, hey, I'm glad he wrote it because I know he has been holding in a lot for a long time.
Wow.
And I'm so glad he finally got it out. And if he got some more, let him write another one, you know. So I don't want to broadly categorize any group of people. There between my mother and my grandmother is a great microcosm of response.
With a lot in between there. Let's take another short break. We'll get back to our conversation with Casey Gerald. And again, he's got a new memoir called There Will Be No Miracles Here. And you can join us 1-888-477-9499. Radio Times at WHYY.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane talking with Casey Gerald about his life. And just to encapsulate some things here, grew up outside of Dallas with parents struggling with substance abuse and with mental illness. He was a standout student and football player, recruited to attend Yale University, which he did. He later went on to Harvard Business School, became an entrepreneur, and considered a kind of a living example of the American dream. In fact, we posted a TED Talk he gave a couple of years ago on our Facebook page. But interestingly, that time in his life got him thinking about what his life was about, and that, in a sense, is what his memoir is about as well. 1-888-477-9499. When you were at Yale, I think you described yourself as, you know, first of all, that was the loneliest place in the world to be, and I can imagine coming from a largely black community to New Haven and Yale University, the campus there, but also feeling as if you were just stood bitter and alone and reclusive, and probably a lot of pressure on you as well to sort of excel.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, the Yale material is so important. When I first went to Yale, there were posters posted through every public school in Dallas that said, look who's going to Yale. He did it. You can too. That gets to the heart of the intervention in this book, which tries in some ways to kill Horatio Alger forever. To turn the American dream. Horatio Alger's not a friend of mine.
No, yeah. I get that. Right.
To turn the American dream narrative on its head, I realized that that poster encapsulated the way in which I was used to justify an unjust system. I am a glitch in the American machine, which relies on this fantasy called the American dream. You take a kid like me, send him off to Yale, to Harvard Business School, put him on the cover of a magazine, put him at George Bush's dinner table, and it helps us to ignore the fact that there's a conveyor belt leading most children from in this country from nothing to nowhere. Kids in my neighborhood are expected to make $21,000 a year. That's less than our parents made. And that's the same for many other places around the country. I mean, I spent 3 years driving 40,000 miles across America. I've seen America from the very bottom to the very top, and I can promise you that one Casey Gerald is not enough to justify the suffering of children in this country, which is structurally guaranteed on a daily basis.
Do you know why you were a glitch?
In part, and I'm a bit of a mystic, so in part perhaps because I needed to tell this story. Maybe, you know, I write in the beginning and says the boy needs to travel this journey alone, and if he doesn't need to, which as the boy would be my argument, then he will anyway. That's quite possible. Mm-hmm. But there's a more specific reason. There was a boy, when my life sort of fell apart, my response was to try to bring perfect order to myself and to the world. When my mother started disappearing, I'd walk the sidewalk, and I'd say, if I only put one foot in every sidewalk square perfectly, she'll be there when I get home. And it worked once. And so it kind of put in me that if I just eradicated all imperfection, if I pleased everybody, if I conformed to whatever those in power wanted me to do, they'd like me, they might give me some food, they might give me a place to stay. And that worked. It just so happened it was a dead end. Yeah. There was another boy in my class, a fifth grade class, Mauricio, who also had some crazy things going on in his life. But his response was to lie down in the middle of the road and wait for a car to run him over.
You mean that literally?
Literally. He was punished, plied with ADD medicine, probably paddled, probably forced to repeat the fifth grade, you see. So the thing that I'm trying to say is that we can't ask children, ask young people, to mutilate themselves and conform just to please enough people that they might have a chance to make it somewhere else. And so, there's a cost to this making it. My editor told me yesterday, you know, she said, part of what you're saying is that a ticket out is not a free ride. And it's not. And the cost of that journey often is your very life.
We've done a number of shows about children growing up in certain parts of Philadelphia that mm-hmm. are poor and dangerous in many ways, violent in many ways, where children will hear the sound of gunfire, if not every night, a couple mm-hmm. nights a week. And there's this thing that people are now talking about, toxic stress, which mm-hmm. is, in a sense, children living in what could be a war zone pay an emotional price. They pay a physiological price for living under that kind of stress.
Yeah. And most importantly, and this is what I think this book, I hope, will do. The bill on all that stress has come due for us as a country. Hmm. When I say America has reached a dead end, I mean, I don't have to give you much evidence of that. I mean, just this past week, we've gotten enough proof that this country is deeply, deeply wounded, just like a little child almost. And people always ask me, well, where do we go from here? And I say, well, where is here? There's not a GPS in the world, Marty, that can give you directions to a destination without knowing your current location. And this book, in part because I just happened, like Forrest Gump, to be everywhere.
I kind of was.
You see what I'm saying? I was just kind of a lot of places. You know, I was on Wall Street
and people were paying attention.
And I was paying attention.
Yes.
And I wrote it all down. And I think, hopefully, if we can understand how we got here, and I think this book helps do that, then maybe we can put that in our GPS and say, hey, we want to go to a country that is fair, that is equal, that is not awful for women and children and poor people and colored people and immigrants, et cetera, et cetera.
I pulled out another section to have you read. We put a post-it in there if you want to read that section from your book.
I did what I was supposed to do and did not do what I was not supposed to do. At least that's what I tried to do. Even in the nighttime, while I slept, when they said I moved around too much, I tried to stop moving and quickly learned to lie still for 6 or 7 hours through the night. Could lie real still for however long I needed to, even when I had a cold, when my cold was keeping people up, and they said I'd have to sleep on the couch if I could not stop my cough, and I tried, and sure enough, I could stop that too. Well, actually, I could not stop coughing all the way, but I did learn to cough so soft, so low, that no one hardly noticed. I could stay so quiet that no one had to hear me if they did not want to hear me. And when they did want to hear me, when they wanted me to speak, I learned to speak so they could hear exactly what I said. Enunciate, they told me, and that's exactly what I did. I spoke loud and clear, and when they warned me that I fidgeted, which was not okay, I stood real still and kept my hands still, too, unless it was the right time to move them with purpose. It took some work to speak and stay still and move my hands with purpose, to hold those hands like a real man, not behind my head like I was getting arrested, not limp wrist like a little girl. I already sounded like a girl, of course, but that was just my voice. Nobody told me how to fix it. So I did it on my own, or tried, or waited. And soon enough, I sounded like a man, or nearly. And that was good, it seemed. Everything was good, all good. I took it all in stride, or silence, whatever. I saved my tears for bathroom faucets. I worked the muscles of my face so it looked as if I smiled. I was good to the program. Whatever the program was, I was good to it. Tried to be, at least. I kept my ass low and kept my eyes open and ran for my life. I really did. Just kept on running, threw my hats away and switched my jeans and changed my voice again so nobody needed a translator on the practice field. Fixed my resume and bought new dress shirts and acted like a lawyer, like a banker, did that well enough. Learned my story, told my story, got the right perspective on it all. I was grateful. I moved on. I got over it. Stayed up late, ran away from men and nightmares, worked to be the best and brightest, be the president, be somebody at the top. It had taken nearly every day to turn the boy that I had been into the man that I became, a dead man.
Do you feel that way now?
I feel very alive.
Yeah.
Because again, I chose to get the death out of my basket.
Yeah.
And as I started this book, This is the most important thing that happened in the writing of this book. A few months into it, I got to the kind of Horatio Alger material, you know, I'm now about to go to Yale. And I got real sad, Marty, and I couldn't write for a couple of days. So I took a nap, ate it by some bourbon, and I'm asleep. And my friend, a few months before, had committed suicide. He was like a little brother to me. I'd helped recruit him to Yale. He'd also had a similar sort of Horatio Alger journey. And it just sort of broke my heart when it happened, but I still didn't totally understand why it had affected me so much. And so I took this nap, and my friend came to me in a dream, and he was sitting in a booth in a diner, and he said, "You know, Casey, we did a lot of things that we would not advise anybody we love to do." And then I woke up. I knew what he meant. I knew that if you look at it from the right angle, a boy picking himself up by his bootstraps looks like a suicide. And so the thread of this book runs on those two tracks.
Right.
It has to warn young people all those things they're asked and invited to do that are going to kill them. And it also invites people to imagine what it actually would mean to live, to be whole, to be free, to be a better person, better friend, better lover, to know God for real, not some fearful ritual. I hope I succeeded in that for my friend and for myself.
For sure. It's interesting to hear you talk and also to think about that passage, having watched your TED Talk, where mm-hmm. you look so present and so the way you use language and the way the audience was reacting to you, you looked like you were on this pinnacle mm-hmm. of success. But clearly underneath all of that mm-hmm. were all these questions and doubts and fears.
Sure. Underneath all that was a choice. In some ways, my TED Talk is the most elaborate resignation letter in the history of the country. I mean, really, it's 18 minutes of basically saying I quit. You know, right. It's saying a lot
Although
of
I
other
think
things.
People in the audience probably felt like, I want to be like Casey Terrell.
Sure, but I mean, you know, I say this about this book. You know, books and hopefully art in general, they're not the same thing as McDonald's Happy Meals. You know, you don't go through and say, oh boy, I got it. If it works well, then there are many layers of meaning. Steinbeck used to say about Grapes of Wrath, there are 5 layers to the book, and a reader will get however many layers they are prepared to receive. That's the case. So for me, Yeah, there are five or six layers to that TED Talk. One, and perhaps the most important one, is there must be a better way, which means that this way that I've been on ain't it. Okay. Yeah.
You also include a letter that you wrote as a sixth grader. I can't read the whole thing. It's to Senator Blasey Blah. But basically you're saying to him, you lied to me, and I am not going to forgive you for that, and I am going to call you out. And you even say here that you had considered being a politician, which as an adult you actually considered being, what, governor of Texas?
No, I considered being president of the United States. What are you talking about, Marty? Don't lower my ambitions. No, this is one of the first books, I think, written by somebody who was very serious about being president that is not written to be president. You know, you read all these books and you just know, oh, God, when is he or she running for something? You know what I mean? I ain't running for nothing, okay? I was back on campus at Yale a few years ago talking to a group of young people, and I said, listen, we got very good at training great dead people. What we really have to learn how to do is train free people. This is a book about being free, not about being great. And so going back to that letter to the senator who had lied to me and lied to a lot of other people, I'm sure, what I say in there is that people suffer when those in power don't do their jobs.
Right.
How much more evidence do we need of that? So, you know, one of the things I write about football is when I was a freshman at Yale, we staged a coup against the upperclassmen because they really sucked. Actually, we were here in Philadelphia playing Penn, and Penn beat us from two ways till November. I mean, it was just really embarrassing. And we got back on the bus, and the 12 freshmen, we said, these guys suck. And we had a freshman-only meeting the other day, and we staged a coup. And we became the winningest class in a generation. I use that as a metaphor for this moment we are in as a country. Mm-hmm. The people in charge have not done their jobs. I was listening to Adam Liptak talk about what the implications of this Supreme Court justice's confirmation are going to be. And he said gun rights are going to increase, abortion rights are going to decrease, it's going to be harder to vote, affirmative action is going to be dead, all the concerns. And I said, no. People, there's a critical mass of us, just like it was a critical mass of those freshmen, who say that agenda and that vision of our society sucks, and we're not going to take it. So some people are going to have to lose their jobs, starting in the midterm elections, I suppose.
Well,
hopefully.
Time will tell. We will see about that.
Yeah.
So what does an MBA, what does that mean to you now? From Harvard, no less.
Well, I tell folks that really Harvard Business School is not designed to train people for business. It's designed to train people for power. Okay.
Anything wrong with that?
Oh, without question. There's a lot wrong with it. There's a woman at the Aspen Institute for Business says, business is to this age what the church was to the Middle Ages. It's the most important institution in society. If that's true, then places like Harvard Business School are like the Vatican. And if that's true, then we are in desperate need of a reformation.
Mm.
Okay. That's what having an MBA from Harvard means for me. I have seen the very molten core of the power centers and power structures of this country and perhaps the world. And I'm telling you, not with some propaganda, but with the truth, that we're in real trouble if we keep it as it is.
We're getting in on that note. Casey Gerald, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Had a great time, Marty. Thank you.
Us as well. And the book is called There Will Be No Miracles Here. In fact, it's a memoir. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times, and you can find out more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, and follow us on Twitter. I should add that our guest is speaking tonight at the Penn Book Center at 6 o'clock. That's in West Philadelphia, 130 South 34th Street. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Alex Stern. I'm Marty Moscow. Thank you for joining us.